Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, Galaxy S21 Ultra review, and we will also talk about the other two Galaxy S21 phones that Hayato is staying up all weekend to finish. So thanks, buddy. Appreciate that. We'll talk about a new FCC acting chair. She is a Democrat, and what that means for the rebirth of the net neutrality movement, maybe, or maybe just better rural internet for people like Jerry. We will talk about Chromebooks. Ara is going to get very nerdy about a lot of Chromebooks announced last week or this week or next week. Who knows? There's just too many Chromebooks. And we will talk about iMessage for Android. Is that finally a thing? Sort of. It depends if you have an old jailbroken iPhone 4S that you want to use as a mediator. We'll get into that. And then if we have enough time, we will talk about MediaTek unveiling its Snapdragon 888 competitor. We'll talk a little bit about Oppo and OnePlus merging their R&D. And we might even talk a little bit about Android 12 because, you know, it's 2021 and that means that the first Android 12 developer preview is coming sooner than you think. All right, Ara, Jerry, Hayato, how you doing?
You know, I got a full night's sleep last night for the first time in 72 hours. I'm feeling pretty good.
Beautiful. I can feel your awakeness through the internet. We were on a call yesterday where you were basically falling asleep at the wheel.
Oh, man.
If you had been driving, I would have called the police on you. So
that was after a good 25 minutes of sleep that night prior.
Yeah, and it worked because you did a really nice job on the Galaxy S21 Ultra reviews. So let's start there because you did the written review, you did the video, you basically, you know, you did everything you needed to do to prove that you're good at your job. So, you know, thanks for that. But we're also, you know, 11 a.m. yesterday was the embargo, which meant it wasn't just your review, it was everybody's that went live at the same time. And as we are wont to do, we publish ours and then we go and look at, you know, all of our friends' content. And the consensus around the S21 Ultra is that it's the best Android phone today, period. Everything Samsung did seemed to be a home run from hardware to software, sort of. We'll get into that a little bit. But from a hardware perspective, this is about as good as it gets. Cameras are amazing with a couple of caveats that I want you to talk about. But largely, like, if you are okay with big-ass phones, this is a really, really good deal, really good product, and it's cheaper. So give us, like, I was going to say the 30-second elevator pitch, but for a phone this important, give us, like, the 3-minute elevator pitch on, like, why the S21 Ultra is your go-to Android phone right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of nailed it right there, that it's cheaper and it's better than its predecessor. The Galaxy S20 Ultra was just as giant, but it was pretty flawed. The cameras had some focusing issues. It was really ugly design, if that's something that you care about. And there were just little things all over the place that made me I was not a big fan of the S20 Ultra. This phone, they really dramatically improved the design. They improved the cameras actually quite a bit. The screen has a ton of new features that maybe not everybody's going to care about, but if you're a display nerd or a video nerd, you're probably going to enjoy those as much as I am. There's just very little to complain about with the S21 Ultra. You know, people are going to get down on the fact that there's no micro SD slot. I think that was a long time coming. Whether you like that decision or not, it's a thing that was going to happen eventually.
I don't think anybody likes that decision, but, like,
I'm pretty indifferent on it, honestly.
Yeah, like, can we just accept that it is a trend that is happening? Like, unless you're LG, you're just over expandable storage. Sorry to interrupt. I find it really fascinating that, like, this was a thing 5 years ago when the Galaxy S6 didn't have micro SD, and there was such a massive reaction that Samsung put it back in with the Galaxy S7, and everybody was like, oh, okay, they came to their senses. I have not seen the same reaction en masse this time around. Like,
no.
It just doesn't seem like because the base storage is so much higher, 128 versus 32 gigs back then. I think people are just kind of more accepting of that fact, but it does obviously stem from the fact that Samsung wanted to keep prices down.
Sure. And I mean, for what it's worth, we're still getting a lot of comments in the review, both written and video, that are just saying, you know, I'm not going to buy this because it doesn't have an SD slot, et cetera. But I think that's largely just a vocal minority at this point.
And they're also lying. I mean, let's be honest. They are lying. If they're going to buy this phone, they're going to buy it. It's not because it doesn't have a micro SD slot. If they were going to buy it in the first place, is what they're saying.
Right. I mean, there are a few other missing features here. I didn't even mention the headphone jack in the review, I don't think, because that's not anything new, really. They did away with that last year. And pretty much everybody's been getting rid of that over the years. The S21 Ultra also doesn't have MST support. I think that is not even really worth talking about extensively because, I mean, like, NFC has been the mobile payment system going forward for years. But people are, again, up in arms about that, and it is what it is. Other than those, like, small feature removals, though, I mean, this really, again, the display has been wildly improved. It's way brighter at 1500 nits. It's got double the contrast ratio, 5 million to 1. It's a gorgeous display. And of course, you can run 120 hertz and Quad HD Plus at the same time. This is the first time any Samsung phone has done that, and it looks really good. Although, it does have a bit of a toll on battery life. I'm wondering if that's just been my usage. I don't think I'm a very hard user of my phone, but it seems like every other review, people have been saying that they've had really good battery life, even running both settings at the same time on the display.
Dave2D didn't. His video said, because I spent like most of last night just watching all the reviews.
Yeah, me too.
And his review said that it wasn't getting all day, like it was like a day plus a couple of hours in terms of battery. So
even that's more than I got.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, yeah, who knows? I mean, it could be that you just had the brightness up higher than other people typically do, or who knows, maybe you had like a background process.
I'm wondering if Phi has anything to do with it, because I think I remember last year people mentioned with their S20 Ultra reviews that for whatever reason Phi was causing a lot more battery drain, and that's my carrier of choice. So that's
right.
Who knows? I've had great battery life on like the Pixel 5 with Phi and a lot of other phones, but this one, I mean, I'm still it's enough to go through the day, no problem. But I'm ending every day with about 10% left, where most phones with my usage, I've got like 30-ish to go by the end of the day. So it's not bad by any means, regardless.
I want to talk a little about MST before we move on, because Jerry wrote an editorial on the site today that I thought is raising a good point. So a lot of people talk about the convenience of MST, about how it's basically just this magical hack that imitates a magnetic stripe from a credit card. But the convenience of that is because it is not that secure.
Right.
And the credit card issuers and the banks they hate MST.
Right.
Because it opens them up to more liability. Legally, like, you are more liable, period, because there are laws that hold these banks more accountable for fraud that is undertaken with magnetic stripe-based payments, just because they're inherently less secure. But also, they just don't want people using magnetic stripes anymore because it is inherently less secure. It is one of those older technologies that has been supplanted. And Jerry, I'd love you to talk about this move to chip and PIN and NFC based payments. What about that is more secure than MST?
You know, I'm going to be 100% honest, and a lot of that I don't know, but I do know that number one, chip and PIN and NFC are both what you call close contact. You have to be within, you know, centimeters for the data to transfer.
Millimeters.
I misspoke. Whereas MST is, your phone emulates a magnetic credit card or debit card Stripe, and it just sends that to a payment terminal from, you know, like actual centimeters away, like 10 centimeters away. You, if you've used MST from your Samsung Galaxy phone, you know that, yeah, you have to hold it up there, but you don't have to hold it and touch it. You can kind of like use it from your hand. So there's a longer transmission distance of data means that maybe if I'm standing beside you, I could grab that data. And it's also still susceptible to credit card skimmers. And those, whether you know it or not, are a big deal. When you go to the gas station, if it's not a chip and pin pump, don't use it.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, it's and banks want rid of this so bad. They want rid of MST really bad, but you know, endpoint payment processors don't want to spend the money to upgrade their equipment. And you know, that's a 5 year ago argument. Now, if you live where I live, you'll still see a lot of MST terminals. Anywhere else in the country, anything new is probably NFC.
I mean, here in Indianapolis, there are very few gas stations I run into that support NFC. But I mean, you can at least, like, if you want to use your phone, you can just like download the app for that gas station, and that'll usually do the trick.
That's so annoying. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yep.
Like, you have to download an app specifically to pay at a particular brand.
It's not my favorite, but it's a thing.
All right, Hayato, let's talk a little bit about the cameras. So you took a ton of photos for this review. You took you used the main camera. Obviously the focusing issue was the focus of the camera section, but it's more than that, right? This is a really improved sensor. It's a second generation sensor from Samsung. It's 108 megapixels. It uses a couple of interesting things to fix the fact that it's a large sensor, right? So when you get close to an object, and because of the large depth, because of the shallow depth of field the large sensor creates, it immediately automatically transitions to the ultra wide to get you a longer plane of focus, right? And it's stuff like that that really, it's like this invisible intelligence that Samsung is finally using, not as a gimmick, but just to make your experience better.
Yeah, there's a lot of automatic switching going on. I mean, like you said, if you get close up, like for a macro kind of shot, it'll switch to the ultra wide sensor right away, which can get much, much closer. It's got a really, really close minimum focus distance. You also, like, if you're taking a selfie and it sees that there is more than one face in the shot, it'll actually switch to the sort of wider perspective on the front facing camera automatically as well. You can kind of watch it like bounce between the two perspectives if you like switch from one person to two people in the shot, which is kind of interesting. And I mean, the camera itself is just fantastic. The main 108 megapixel sensor, like you said, it's a Gen 2. So last year's was really good on its own. It had a fantastic natural bokeh, so you almost didn't need to use a portrait mode. This time it's the same deal, but there's also much better low light performance. So you can sort of do the same thing and not have to switch to a night mode to get a really clean looking night shot. So it'll automatically switch if it detects that there's not enough light. But even without night mode, without that sort of 2 second long exposure, you can, like, you get the best of both worlds, where you get that natural depth of field as if you were taking a shot in portrait mode, and then you also get the really clean imaging of a night shot without really needing to use that mode either.
Right.
It does have the very classic Samsung look to it. You're still not gonna, you know, you're not gonna mistake this for like a DSLR shot or anything. So highlights are very overblown. You know, colors are very vivid, but that's the look that Samsung has been known for years, and that's a thing that you're either gonna really like because they do it because people like it, or if you're like me, it might not be your favorite, but it's, you know, it's not gonna ruin a photo or anything. I think one of the big things that is very appealing to somebody like me is that you can also switch to Pro mode and take photos in 12-bit RAW, and that really lets you sort of tame back a lot of that Samsung look and you really get a lot of color depth information to work with, so you can tweak photos without worrying about, you know, breaking the colors, getting a lot of artifacting when you're pushing maybe the highlights all the way back down, or doing whatever you want with the photo in post. I've edited a couple of photos from RAW to something that I would want to post, and it's you get so much control in something like Lightroom with having a 12-bit RAW image. It gives you a ton of flexibility, and that's been one of my favorite features of the camera. And I mean, other than that, you know, you're dealing with pretty much the same ultra wide as last year, and then the two telephoto lenses that I think are something I really want to see in pretty much every flagship moving forward. Now that I've used it, having a 3x and a 10x, so you can have really high quality shots at either zoom length, makes a really big difference. I think it's a huge improvement over last year.
Yeah, it's very rare that I'm amazed when I see camera photos. Like when we first saw these massive sensors from Huawei and then Samsung, you just get this clarity and fidelity in the perfect light. You know, you get one or two photos that are just like, holy shit, how is this from a phone, right? With the Galaxy S21 Ultra, I had that experience with the zoom, where I was like, this is a 30x photo that looks like it was taken with a decent telephoto lens on an SLR. You know, obviously when you blow it up, like if you're a photographer listening, please don't send me an angry email. I know that it's not the same as like attaching a 500 mil lens to a Canon, a high quality Canon camera. But really, like if you're not scrutinizing it on a massive screen and you're not doing, you know, proper color correction, and you're just looking at it on a phone, or you know, you're not going to blow it up and put it on a poster. The quality is intense, is amazing. It's really incredible, and the fact that it's usable at 30x, whereas last year it really was not, is a testament to how much Samsung has improved the whole experience. The whole flow from beginning to end, the fact that it's stabilizing the shot, right? So that it can lock onto a particular target, so you're not shaking like crazy, all the way to the shutter, to the processing, just feels so much more complete than last year.
Yeah, and I think that sort of the way that it stabilizes when you're zooming is a really big improvement over last year, because last year it gave you that little preview in the upper corner that just shows you like the entire shot versus the rest of the viewfinder shows like your zoomed shot. And that was helpful, but now you can tap on that preview to really lock the focus on a subject. And that way it's going to use the stabilization to keep the image fairly still. It's still a little shaky, just because if you're shooting at 30x or higher, it's going to be shaky when you're doing handheld, but it makes a really big difference in terms of just getting a nice steady shot. Even if you're like walking around it at 10x digital zoom on top of whatever zooming you're actually using, it is still going to be a little rocky, but it's way better than shooting without any kind of like locking zoom like that.
You know, right. Can I just say that I hate Apple for all of this? I have a dog and a granddaughter that can both run 700 miles an hour. and that's the kind of pictures I want. I want to be able to point my phone, hit the shutter, and take the picture and make it happen. I don't care about any of this other stuff. I'm glad it's there for people who do care about it, but it's like we forgot that people like to take pictures of their kids running around, and there's no longer...
Nobody forgot that, Jerry. I definitely did not forget that.
Right. So you know how many pictures are just trash. And there's no... That's what I want to see people focus on. I want that picture of your daughter, you know, going 300 miles an hour with a pair of scissors and your look of horror trying to chase her down to take them away. I want that picture to be in focus and sharp.
You know, me too, actually.
Yeah, you'd like that photo. I think I can make that happen. She's really into running around with scissors these days. Bad influence. So when I don't have the phone yet, and the first thing that I'm going to check when I have it is, can it take a photo of my daughter without smoothing the crap out of her face? And it's been a problem with Samsung phones forever. Apparently, Samsung has fixed this year. It allows you to remove every bit of face smoothing from the selfie camera to the back camera. And I appreciate that. And I cannot wait to test those, because if that's the case, then I can finally use a Galaxy phone as a replacement for my Pixel or my iPhone when it comes to taking photos of my daughter. The other problem that Samsung has always had that I doubt has been corrected this year is, in anything but outdoor bright sunlight, it will keep the shutter speed to like 1/30, 1/40 to keep the ISO, the light sensitivity, as low as possible. So in a situation where my daughter is running around, it'll be blurry every time unless I turn on pro mode. And Apple has figured out that if you have a subject that's running, you're going to keep that shutter speed to 1/90, 1/120, and risk it being a little bit darker or a little bit more grainy. I think Google has found a pretty nice happy medium too with the Pixel, but I don't think Samsung has done that. And I'd love for it to understand that a subject is in motion, even a little bit in motion. Like, I'm not talking about running across the room with scissors. I'm just talking about like acting like a toddler and moving all the time and being like, okay, this subject is moving right now. Let's use some of that intelligence that we've been working on for half a decade and apply it by ramping up the shutter speed a little bit. I don't know. I have a couple questions about the photo experience. So there's a photo in what looks like a bar. It's of five bourbon bottles, and it's an ad for $5 old fashions every Wednesday.
Oh yeah.
That's a nice photo.
Looks like a bar.
Is that using the tele lens?
That was using the 3X, yeah.
3X, right. So we have another situation where this is not actually a 3X zoom. It's a high megapixel sensor that's cropped down to 12 megapixels, right? And it's using that crop as its, quote, optical zoom. But it still looks really good. And I wonder, do you see improvements of this camera, the 3X, over last year in terms of like processing?
Yeah, I mean, so this year they're using, it's a 3X native, versus last year was, I think, a 4X on the S20 Ultra.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I mean, the shots look a lot cleaner to me. I mean, I'm looking at that photo right now on the phone, and you can sort of zoom in and actually read the smaller text on each bottle, which is, you know, it's not like super crystal clear, but it's definitely better than I would expect considering how small that text is in the shot.
God, I'm so sorry. I'm completely wrong. They're not doing that for the Ultra this year. They're doing it for the smaller phones. So
right, this is just
my bad.
The
it's
native
a 10
zoom.
Megapixel native 3X. My bad. I take back everything I just said. So remove that. Don't remove it, Jim, because I'm okay being an idiot. But it does look considerably better, and that makes sense because it's no longer cropping in the sensor. It's actually proper. So
right.
Continue.
I mean, it is worth noting, though, anything above 3X but below 10X, that is going to be digital zoom. But I think that's really where having dual telephoto lenses comes in handy is, you know, I don't think most people really go in between all that often. Like 3X is pretty good, right? Like people sort of decided a couple of years ago, 2X was not quite enough. So 3X gets you a little further because 2X you can fill out with digital zoom. Anything between there and 10X, I don't think is like, people don't really do that very often as far as I know. You still can, it's just going to be a little bit digital. And then, you know, once you get to 10X, if you really want to take like a very distant shot, that's going to, again, be very clear. The cameras are I think identically spec'd at 10 megapixels with the same, I think it's 1.22 nanometers.
Yeah, that looks like.
The only difference is the aperture. So I'm trying to remember the spec sheet. I think it's f2.2 on the 3X sensor and f4.9 on the 10X.
Yeah, 2.4 it says.
2.4.
I now have the spec sheet in front of me so that I don't make another terrible mistake. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, right? Because the light is being refracted through the periscope. This is a longer periscope this time. So, you know, obviously you lose availability for that aperture as you extend the length of that tube, and then it obviously hits that prism and bounces up. So I don't know. It's fascinating. This is a really neat solution to a problem that phone makers have had for years. And I remember Huawei being really proud of this when they debuted it on the P30 series. And it's just gotten better and better, right? We've seen it in Oppo phones. We've seen it now in Samsung phones for 2 years, for a year. I'm sure a lot of other manufacturers will adopt this. I'm sure OnePlus will probably adopt this with the OnePlus 9 Pro this year, especially since, as we'll talk about, Oppo and OnePlus are unifying their R&D. So, okay, let's finish up the conversation with just some final thoughts on the S21 Ultra. Is this the best phone you can buy today, or do you think it's worth kind of waiting on OnePlus and, I don't know, some other company to come out with a phone that'll potentially beat it?
I mean, I think, especially if photography is your main priority, then yeah, this is, like, just bar none, the best phone you can buy in early 2021. I don't think, especially, again, for photography, I don't think there's much of a need to wait for something like a OnePlus device, which is not to say, like, OnePlus phones take bad photos. I think the 8 Pro actually took great photos. But it's not on this level. At least it hasn't been so far. So I think if photography is your main priority, then yeah, this is absolutely the best option. For everything else, you know, I mean, the display is, again, the best of the best. But if you're more in it for the software or just for just having a generally good phone, you're going to have plenty of options. I don't think you need to narrow it down to just this one. But from a camera perspective, this is the phone to beat from now on. I really wish that I could get the S21 Ultra in a smaller size, which obviously that's what the other S21 models are for, but I want this exact design and camera system in a phone that actually fits in my hand and pocket more comfortably.
Yeah. It does seem like that's just something Samsung and Apple are not willing to do anymore. They are increasingly differentiating their high-end phones now more than ever. So it's like they're not going... They're moving in the opposite direction. They are leaning into the Pro and Ultra lines as the big differentiator phone models that they can charge a lot more for. And I think that'll only get more extreme as price elasticity just becomes a lot more of a focus for people, right? If you want a cheap, quote, cheap Galaxy, you get the FE or the entry-level S, and if you want the best of the best, you get the Ultra.
And I think it's funny, like, I'm holding both phones right now side by side, the S21 and the S21 Ultra. And for one, the S21 feels almost half the weight of the Ultra. It's so much lighter. But there really are very, very few differences when it comes to actual usability. I mean, you've got a plastic back and no S Pen support. But otherwise, you know... Again, if you're not in it for the cameras primarily, there's really not much reason to buy the Ultra over the S21, especially for $400 more. And even the cameras on the S21, as far as I've tested so far, are also really good. They're just not the crazy, you know, the super extra cameras that you get on the Ultra. Mm-hmm. So I think there's still very much a case to be made for the $800 S21. But yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, for photography, the Ultra is definitely the one to beat.
It's just weird because last year the S21 Plus ended up being the de facto go-to because the S20 Ultra was so flawed.
Yeah.
That's not going to be the case this year. And I don't think anybody's going to buy the Plus because it's not like we're not calling like that $1,000 price the sweet spot anymore because it's really not. And you get so much with the $800 regular S21. The only thing you don't get is the glass the glass back. You get a plastic back.
Yeah.
But other than that, the smaller screen and smaller battery obviously come into consideration. But I don't think the screen is small, nor is the battery objectively. So what are you really getting by upgrading to the Plus?
Right. I mean, I think it says something that Samsung only sent out the regular and the Ultra to reviewers. As far as I know, nobody has a Plus yet.
Not that I know of.
Yeah. I mean, I think the goal there was really just to show that you can get the same experience no matter what price you're willing to pay within the S21 series. And so the S21 Plus is just, yeah, I don't see many people buying it, especially because it's about the same size as the Ultra. I mean, it's a 6.7-inch screen versus a 6.8. You're getting a smaller camera housing, but other than that, I don't think it's much smaller as far as I can tell. So it's not like a choice of, you know, small, medium, or large. It's just small, big, big with better cameras. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little shorter. So it's like 3.6 millimeters shorter. It's the same width exactly, and then it's about a millimeter thinner than the S21 Ultra. And that doesn't include the camera bump, I'm guessing.
Right.
So it's definitely not small the way that the S20 Ultra was so much bigger than the S20 Plus. I bought the S20 Plus because I loved the size. I thought it was the perfect size. I thought the cameras were great. And I'm sure that's true of the S21 Plus, but you lose so much going from one generation to the other, right? You lose that QHD Plus display. You go from 12 gigs of RAM to 8. You just don't get any improvements in the cameras. I believe the cameras are identical. So all you get is the improved software processing through the Snapdragon 888. I want to talk a little bit about, Jerry, the differences that we've learned so far between the Snapdragon 888 and the Exynos 2100, because we talked about how, you know, we knew that the Exynos would be competitive this year, but what's clear is that it's not competitive. It's not as competitive in the GPU side as we were hoping. That Mali GPU just is not as good as Qualcomm's Adreno GPUs. So walk us through a little bit about what we know so far.
Samsung is able to build a CPU that's as good. I'll use that phrase and say it as good as what Qualcomm has built with the Snapdragon 888. But there's more to it, just more to, you know, performance than just the CPU. The Exynos is clocked a little bit faster. It actually can do calculations standalone a little bit faster than, you know, what Qualcomm can do. But then as soon as you start to use the GPU, which I don't think people realize, that means as soon as you turn your phone on through the UI and everything, you start to see where, you know, the stock ARM Mali GPU just doesn't stand up, and nobody's even bothered to test the RF and connectivity, which is where the Snapdragon will just like throw a nuclear bomb into the ring and the John Cena song will play.
I mean, maybe, but we also know that the European 5G situation is very different. The Asian 5G situation is very different than the US. Maybe this is sort of too early to tell, but when NVIDIA bought ARM, part of the conversation was like, what's going to happen to Mali, right? What's going to happen to the GPU side of the business? Will NVIDIA influence that and make it a differentiator? But we do know that Samsung is working with AMD to build mobile GPUs into its chips. And we're not sure whether they're going to be in phones or whether it'll be used in some other way. But
that'll make it to phones eventually, but I think that some other way is how it's going to start. I agree with you there.
If you're using anything other than Indeed for your hiring, you are wasting your time. Hire great people faster with Indeed. Only pay for results and get back time in your schedule. Indeed.com is the hiring site that helps you find quality candidates instantly with Indeed Instant Match. So you can do the part you really need faster, meeting and hiring great people. Unlike some hiring sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility, delivering a high-quality shortlist faster. With Indeed, there are no long-term contracts. You can pause your account at any time, and you only pay for what you need. Indeed searches through the millions of resumes in their database to help show you great candidates instantly. With Instant Match, you see a list of great candidates with zero wait. And Indeed delivers four times more hires than all other job sites combined, according to Talent Nest. Do you want your quality candidate shortlist fast? You need Indeed right now. Our listeners get a free $75 credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/ACP. This is Indeed's best offer available anywhere. Get a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/ACP. Indeed.com/ACP, offer valid through March 31st. Terms and conditions apply. Thank you so much, Indeed, for sponsoring the Android Central podcast. Okay, so if you've been listening to the show, you may notice that there are some parts that cut out a little bit, some parts that don't make a lot of sense. We just stopped talking about Exynos in the middle of a sentence. We've been having a few technical issues, but we're back. We're fine. We're healthy. We're going to move on. Let's just move on. That was a cursed segment. So
it's time to open that second box of wine and just fight through.
We went to a break. We just came back from the break. Our producer Jim is drinking bourbon in the corner, just downing shots. We're so sorry, buddy. All right, Ara, you're back. You were here and then you left because of internet issues, and now you're back. So let's talk about Chromebooks, because there have been a lot of Chromebook announcements over the last couple weeks. There was a few at CES, and then the BETT. What does that stand for again?
British Education or Teachers. I don't remember what the actual
acronym is.
It's an acronym
that where it's a basically an event where a lot of manufacturers launch Chromebooks for education. So have some.
Can I interject and tell everybody that Google told me it stands for Betty White?
Dude, no.
And we're done. Okay, so at CES, we got the Galaxy Chromebook 2, and we got the Acer Chromebook Spin 514, I think. That's how you say it. And then at BETT, we got like a million HP Chromebooks and a few more Acer ones and some Asus ones and a new Chromebox. There's a lot. So don't walk us through every model, because they're mostly the same. Give us the broad strokes of what can we expect from Chromebooks in 2021? How are they better or different from those released last year? What are the priorities, etc.?
Well, this year, the big thing is going to be, this is when we're having our nice big generational change for processors, because most Chromebooks are built on one of like 10 different hardware platforms. There are core platforms that Chromebooks will use, and depending on the platform you are, that determines what AUE date you get. That determines how long you get Chrome OS updates. So this year, or last year and the year before that, most of the budget Chromebooks that we saw were either on the Celeron N4000 or they were on the MediaTek 8183 or 8173 2 years ago. So this year, we're still on the MediaTek 8183, but I'm hoping we see a new one of those towards the end of this year, and then we're getting new Celeron processors in budget model Chromebooks. So instead of the N4000, we're either going to have the N4500 or the N5100. So we're getting slightly more powerful processors in the bare budget Chromebook segment, which is great considering now that more kids are distance learning, budget Chromebooks need to have just a little bit more power, and they need to have more RAM. What was exciting for the HP Chromebooks that we saw this week was all of them had an option for 4 gigabytes of RAM or for 8 gigabytes of RAM. And for school districts that think they're going to be having distance learning as a thing over the next year to 2 years, 8 gigabytes of RAM is probably what you're going to want.
All right. So we did see the launch of a AMD Ryzen-based Chromebook. We've seen hints that this will continue, right? That AMD is just going to be more and more involved in Chromebooks in 2021. How is that going to change the scope of things is, you know, what are we going to see from Google in terms of like new capabilities for these higher, these more powerful processors? What can students expect from kind of the next generation of Chromebooks?
Well, there aren't going to be that many Ryzen powered student Chromebooks. Right now, the only AMD powered Chromebooks that I think I saw on Tuesday was a Snapdragon powered HP. Oh no, there was a Snapdragon powered Acer Chromebook, and there was a MediaTek powered Acer Chromebook. And then everything else was either the MediaTek or the Intel. But Ryzen means that we're going to have more powerful, Ryzen has better graphics than the Celeron processors that we're used to seeing. So having Ryzen, or I guess is it Ryzen or Radeon for the graphics? I'm trying to remember.
It's Radeon.
Radeon, thank you.
Yeah.
But because the Ryzen processors have integrated Radeon graphics, that means that we could potentially see better gaming on Chromebooks over the next year, year and a half. That also means that we might see more battery optimization. The other thing that's worth saying for Radeon graphics is, since these are the first Radeon Chromebooks that we're seeing, we're still seeing a couple of bugs. Like right now, I can't really do my Reddit browsing that well on my Spin 514, because every time it gets to the end of a video, it black screens until I keep scrolling up.
I mean, that's a feature, right? You shouldn't be on Reddit anyway, so I think they're doing you a favor.
I gotta find my news somewhere. Anywho, not just news. I gotta entertain myself from everything that happened for the last 4 years.
All right, TikTok. It's the future.
No.
I gotta say, my Reddit is like only, I'm on like r/cuteanimals or something, and it's pretty great.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so much of our awe and our cute animals is video.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Anywho, but we're still working out a couple of little bugs with those, but those growing pains, which MediaTek Chromebooks had some of those growing pains a couple of years ago. Now it's time for the Ryzen processors and the Qualcomm processor. We still don't have, we now have two Chromebooks that are powered by Qualcomm 7C processors. And I'm willing to bet we're going to see similar little tweaks that need to happen in Chrome OS for those over the coming months. But we haven't been able to test any of those yet, so we can't really say what they're going to be. But the other benefit to the Acer Chromebook 511, which is going to be powered by the 7C, is the battery life is supposed to be insane, but also because it's a Snapdragon, you're going to be able to get LTE on it. Which this is, if Dell also came out with an LTE Chromebook at CES, but it was a two-year-old Chromebook with baseline specs and baseline ports. And it's like, okay, we're going to release this. It's still only going to get, it's still on the AUE date from the old generation, but you can get LTE on it. And we're not going to tell you how much it costs yet. So
It's about time that Chromebooks start getting LTE connectivity regularly. Like, It's not an expensive part anymore. It's not expensive in terms of battery. It should just be in Chromebooks like they are in so many connected tablets. It would make life so much easier when students can actually go and learn outside the home again, when that's a thing. But yeah, I do think that now that Qualcomm is getting into the game, it just feels like this is an underserved market, that there's so much potential there. I'm super excited about it.
I'm excited to play with them. We didn't get full specs for the Acer Chromebooks, though. We just got the high-level overviews for those. So I'm hoping that Acer is willing to give us more RAM and more internal storage, especially as between distance learning and more schools using apps, we need more than 32 gigabytes of internal storage, because using a micro SD card for apps on a Chromebook right now or for the last year or so has been kind of iffy.
Google knows we want to play Cyberpunk on a Chromebook. We know we never will be able to, but there's got to be a middle ground somewhere where Google
Stadia
can. Yeah, well, maybe gaming was the wrong example then, but there's got to be a middle ground for power where a Chromebook can do everything that almost everyone ever wants it to do without any type of major changes to the operating system.
Between Android apps, Linux apps, and the cloud gaming that we are seeing come to Chromebooks more and more, I think we're in a pretty decent place right now. I want to see better Steam integration. But other than that,
I want to be able to open an Excel document that has 300 tabs across the bottom. That's what I want a Chromebook to be able to do. I'd never do that. Oh my God, I would just lose my mind if I had to.
But I mean, that's our podcast rundown.
I was about to say, our podcast rundown is like that. I have no problems updating that on a $300 Chromebook.
Oh, come on. You're killing me. You know what I mean.
I mean, a huge document. You're wanting legitimate Excel. You're wanting a full desktop version of Office 365. You're wanting a full Google version of it.
Right. I want that's got to happen for that last bit of enterprise power user uptake.
Well, but for power user enterprise, we have Parallels now.
That's a crap. That's just a shit Band-Aid. Sorry, Parallels.
It is.
But it is.
Because Parallels is going to be limited to, you have to have the Chrome Enterprise upgrade and you have to be on a managed workstation, which means for anybody who isn't working at a Fortune 500 company, it's not going to be available.
I mean, it's amazing that Parallels could do it and Google can't. I'll give them that, but...
Oh, I'm sure Parallels could do it. It's a matter of Google's limiting it right now, so that way people upgrade.
I'm not going to go that far, but I am going to say that there are legitimate uses that a Chromebook should be powerful enough to handle, yet it can't. Like, you know, I'm not going to say full-blown Photoshop, but what is that, like, light version that they sell to consumers or used to sell, Photoshop Plus?
Photoshop Elements?
Yes. Yes, a Chromebook should be able to do that today. No problem. I know Adobe doesn't make it anymore, but if they did, I should be able to install it as a Chrome app and just go and edit 99% of any photos I need. You know, maybe make some sort of linear, non-destructive video editor.
Do we also just forget that Chromebooks can run Android apps?
Yeah, no, that was going to be my next thing. Because, yeah, what we need for Photoshop and for all of the Adobe apps is Adobe needs to make a full-powered version of these apps that runs on the Android section. Because, Jerry, the thing here is, if we want to keep Chrome OS sandboxed and locked down, you're either going to be installing apps through Android and Google Play, or you're going to be installing them through Linux. Because that's how we keep the system streamlined, sandboxed, and secure. And that's going to be the paramount thing for Chrome.
I still can't even install the basic Premiere Rush on my Galaxy Tab S7, so...
So, you know, maybe that's the solution. Get Adobe to make Android apps that are more than just toys. And I'm sorry,
Get Adobe to do anything on Android.
Right.
Exactly.
Adobe Lightroom on Android is not bad, actually. It's become a pretty good app.
It's okay, but it's still not worth me digging into, as opposed to just using PixelR, Google Photos, and if I really need something, I suppose I could install GIMP.
My big problem with Lightroom on Android is that it doesn't take into account the gesture controls of like everything from Android 10 and up. Like the controls are all at the very, very bottom of the screen in tiny little buttons, and trying to tap those without just accidentally sliding to your previous app or doing something else, especially when some of these controls are like little sliders, it's really clunky on Android, I think.
Well, let's be real. Adobe hasn't cared about anything on Android for, 5 years?
So I think you all are proving my point. I don't care who you point the finger at. You can say Adobe needs to do it, or, you know, a third company like Parallels. This is Google's product.
Yeah.
Google needs to make this happen, and they haven't, and they come up with solutions like, oh, well, you can install Linux apps on your Chromebook. That's great for me. I can whip open the command line, do whatever I want, but there are very few people like me who are out there trying to work for a living and need an honest-to-goodness laptop to do it, or we're going to get to the point where, you know, kids are going to need to run like MATLAB and stuff on their Chromebooks at home. And we're not there. And it's up to Google to fix it.
So Google is going to defer to the developers. The developers are going to wait for Google to make the frameworks a bit more powerful, et cetera. And the chicken and egg will always be as it has been, because that has kept Chrome OS in somewhat of a stasis for years and years. I don't think this is interesting, though, for most listeners, because Chrome on the enterprise is where a lot of the innovation is happening, because a lot more people are using Chromebooks as work computers, but it's just not sexy stuff. It's not what we would consider to be, like, you know, consumer innovation. It's not faster, better, harder, whatever. It's just you can now run parallels. You can now do the, you know, you can basically imitate as best as possible a Windows PC on your Chromebook. What I'm curious about is, assuming that the work from home and, you know, homeschooling situation stays as it is for the next few months, what I want to know, Ara, is what have Chromebook manufacturers, what have laptop manufacturers in general done to adapt to the pandemic? How have they worked their magic to make it more compelling for somebody to buy and replace an older laptop with a Chromebook in 2021?
Well, as I mentioned with HP, the RAM is a big thing, especially when you're in video calls with a lot of participants. Like, if I'm on a $300 Chromebook, I tend to limit the number of people I can see on the screen to like 9 or 16, just to keep it down, so that way I can keep doing stuff on my Chromebook while I'm in a call. If you're in a classroom environment, that really isn't as much of an option for you. Pretty much all of the Chromebooks that I have right now are 8 gigabytes of RAM, except for a Pixelbook that I haven't turned on for a year, and this Chromebook Spin 514, because this one has the 8 gigabytes of RAM and 128 gigabytes of storage. Having options for 8 gigabytes of RAM, especially options for 8 gigabytes of RAM that aren't ridiculously expensive. HP still has the last generation, the X360 11 G3 Education Edition. God, I hate the naming scheme on these things. But they have that for $400, and you get it with a Celeron, 8 gigabytes of RAM and 64 gigabytes of storage for $400. And it's a Chromebook that you can drop off a desk and it should be fine, and it should be able to withstand whatever the heck your kid throws at it or pours in it.
Can we just talk a little bit about the naming schemes for Chromebooks? Because, I mean, they're bad on Windows laptops too. I totally get it. But manufacturers make no attempt to differentiate their versions from one year to the other.
It depends on the manufacturer. Acer is the worst because Acer doesn't differentiate at all. It's the Acer Chromebook 511 is replacing the old Acer Chromebook 511, and the Acer Chromebook 512 is replacing the old Acer Chromebook 512. And if you hold them up next to each other, they look pretty darn similar too. So you have to know what the exact model number is, or you need to be able to tell, okay, this has this processor, so that means it's that generation. And regular people just aren't going to know that stuff.
Right.
HP at least gives you for all of their education stuff, all of their stuff that's aimed at like regular consumers who are shopping on a budget, all of those have a G number in it, so you know what generation it is. For the 11-inch and the 14-inch. The problem is when you get into the higher end.
Chromebook makers don't build Chromebooks for consumers.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. That it's almost like a fringe benefit that Chromebooks have become popular with consumers.
Right.
Because it's like, if I'm a parent searching for the best Chromebook, it is like way more than just finding a good Android phone or something, or like looking online for an immersion blender, as I've been trying to do for the last like 2 weeks. Going to Amazon and searching Chromebooks is just, it's like beating your head against the wall. It's a terrible experience.
So if anybody's worked in a big office environment where you have to walk into, with a purchase order in your hand to try to get a pencil or anything like that, that's who companies like Acer and Asus, that's who they're building Chromebooks for. They're building them for purchasing agents who don't care what the name is. They care about the model number and what improvements does this give me over this model, because I need to buy 1,300 of them.
Yeah. and how much can you save by buying
right
in bulk? But, you know, do I need a touchscreen? So this one will have a touchscreen and this one won't, but they're basically identical. You know, it's just, it feels like this is not, it's not a consumer friendly operation at all. And you need somebody like Ara to cut through the BS.
Yep.
And build, I'll plug our best Chromebook guide. I think it's the best Chromebook guide on the internet. We do this all day, every day. If you read ours, it is easy to understand. It gives you exactly what you need. Go read it if you're looking for a Chromebook. But what's frustrating is that the manufacturers basically obscure any possibility of transparency by just coming out with as many models as humanly possible with minor tweaks to each one to make it easier to buy in bulk depending on what the organization needs. And this has been what's hampering the growth of consumer Chromebook usage as like a regular... Like, I think what Samsung did with the Galaxy Chromebook 2 was... It was, even though it's not necessarily a sequel, Ara, it's still very clear. They came out with one premium model. They came out with a second model, and that's it. That's all they're doing in terms of Chromebooks. It's very clear what their intent is.
Yeah, they learned their lesson from the Chromebook Plus. Hooray!
Yeah, the one was a MediaTek and one was an Intel.
Well, they did two different versions of it, and they didn't always call it the V2. And that was kind of confusing for a while.
Yeah, I remember that.
Maybe they should just name them the Chromebook $199 and the Chromebook $700. That would fix it.
Google sowing even more chaos because it doesn't care. It just wants Chrome OS on as many computers as possible.
Yeah, I would say Lenovo was doing good, but only on their consumer side, not on their education side. Because on their education side, it's you have the 100E, the 300E, and the 500E, and then you have... different generations, and then you have ones that have Intel and ones that have MediaTek. So that's just kind of a cluster as well. Although, that said, I have yet to see a Lenovo education model in stock anywhere in the last 6 months, so it's a moot point.
All right, so lots of Chromebooks. You're going to be reviewing a lot of them. You're going to be talking about it a lot. We'll have you back to talk specifics. If you want, though, because I do want to give you the chance to talk about the Acer Chromebook Spin 514, because this is a really impressive looking laptop in general, and you actually have it. So give us sort of your mini review right now, aside from the Black Reddit videos.
Aside from the Black Reddit video, the only other bad thing I have to say about the Spin 514 is the battery is just okay. Like, I'm getting 6 to 8 hours, depending on how bright I crank the screen up. And the maximum was going to be 10. So that's 8 hours. 8 hours out of 10 isn't terrible. It's just not as good as we're used to seeing on literally everything else. Mm-hmm. But it's also one of those things of, I still think we're getting optimizations done with the Ryzen and the Radeon. So I'm hoping that that's going to go up over the next couple of months, the same way that we saw with the Asus Flip 436 in the Galaxy Chromebook, because when both of those debuted last year, they were the first ones on their platform and their battery suffered because things weren't always optimized, which is the same thing that happened to the Pixel Slate. So if you're the first with your platform, then you're the one that's going to be getting all of the growing pains. So this wasn't the first Ryzen powered Chromebook to be announced, but it's one of the first ones to actually be sold.
Okay.
Because it comes out next month.
Next month, right. Okay, so you got an early model. Cool. So we'll talk more about them when you get a few more, and we'll have you back to talk about that. Let's move on. Jerry, we have a new acting FCC chairwoman. It's the first woman in the role. Her name is Jessica Rosenworcel. She was the part of the minority Democrat team from the previous administration. Now that the Democrats are in power, they have a 3-2 advantage in the FCC, which means that if she is approved, she will be not just the acting chairwoman, but the actual chairwoman to succeed Ajit Pai. This will probably happen in March, so we still have a little ways to go. But talk us through what this means for the FCC. Is it something that can we expect net neutrality to come back to the table? Can we expect more movement in rural internet? You know, bridging the rural divide, as they say. What do you think the short-term and long-term implications are of having a Democrat-controlled FCC again?
Well, first, excuse me, I don't care about Democrat, Republican. I care about, she never was a lawyer for Verizon. So that's a big deal. Ajit Pai was, you know, he was both a lawyer and a lobbyist for a major carrier in the United States and had no business leading the FCC. So we've moved past that. And I think you hit on the two biggest mandates. They have to decide how they want to define net neutrality. They have to find a set of laws that works for enough people to get, you know, approved and pushed through. They're never going to make everybody happy. And then rural broadband has been the promise for the last three administrations. And, you know, a little anecdotal evidence, just for me to have broadband internet that's fast enough so I can work, I pay $180 a month.
Oof.
Because I live in the middle of nowhere. That's crap. That's nonsense. That has to be fixed. I can get internet for $29.99 a month, and it's a 1.3 megabit DSL connection. My next step up is to hit Comcast for cable internet, and they're just there rubbing their hands and smiling when they see me. And that's got to be fixed. We need more choice. We need better infrastructure. And this now would be a good time to make that happen, because traditionally Democrats have been more, you know, they're not so much afraid to take money and then tax us for it. Sometimes that's a good thing. And I think this would be a good thing, not just because it benefits me, but because it benefits all the people that need to work from home, all the kids that need to learn from home, whether there's a pandemic or not.
Yeah, because even if they aren't learning from home, they're still going to go home and do their homework.
Right.
And if you don't have internet at home, then that means you're hobbled for all of your assignments and all of your research. And that just means you're not going to be able to learn as much unless you go other places that have internet.
Go faster. Go past that. Daniel can agree that a child with a screen and the right YouTube or Amazon show is a learning experience, even if that child is, you know, not even close to preschool age. The internet is a tool for people of all ages. And when you make it unavailable to a large portion of the country, that's just not acceptable.
So, well, if it's not about not making it available, it's about making it too expensive,
it's about making it not available. The fact that we deny internet Title II utility status is a stain.
Yeah, I don't think we're going there this administration. We should.
But we should. Because I mean, if we want to deal with rural broadband, and we could also, for a degree, roll net neutrality in it. If you make internet a utility, everything has to be treated the same. Everyone has to be treated the same.
But this is the U.S. Canada shares the problem too. We're not South Korea. We have a billion square miles of nothing that we need to connect somehow if we want to connect San Francisco to Washington, D.C. We have that million, you know, square miles of nothing that needs to be connected.
Yeah, I mean, some people live in Indiana.
Well, you know what I'm talking about then. you and all the corn need to be able to browse Reddit and look at the videos. But seriously, the U.S. does pose very special problems because of its size and the way its population is centered on the, you know, the coasts of the country. Canada's really the same way. Just because everybody in Canada lives, you know, within 50 miles of the U.S. doesn't mean that, you know, communities further north should just be left out. So North America poses a very tough situation to get through. I don't know how you fix that. That's good that I don't lead the FCC. But this administration, I think the big focus is going to be, how do we fix net neutrality in a way that works for whoever's got the loudest shoe to bang on the desk. That's the person you need to satisfy. And then we've got an entire generation that is watching the haves have great broadband internet to do what they want, while they are the have-nots who just don't have an accessible way to do it because maybe their family can't afford $200 a month for internet.
Am I crazy for thinking that if we can get electricity out to every zip code and area that needs it, that we can't get internet out to every zip code and area that needs it?
On the surface, no, you're not. But it's handled in a very different way. You know, that those high tension power electrical lines that go through Hayato's cornfields are way different than, you know, microwave transmissions.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, it's about expense, right? There are areas of the U.S. where there is copper wire, and that copper wire needs to be maintained. And the companies that build the infrastructure or license out to contractors to do that have to decide, do we maintain this legacy copper? Do we try to install fiber to the home, which is a very expensive endeavor, but will be paid back in you know, many times over once it's actually installed. And it's a permanent, one of the beauty of fiber is that it's future proof, right? It's basically just light, and it can be expanded over time as technology, as compression improves. You can just put more information through the same tube, unlike copper unlike coax. And it's that first step of understanding that is, if as many people in the U.S. have access to fiber, you're basically allowing the internet to thrive. And there are so many examples here of small towns that had fiber installed, where fiber to the home was given to at a subsidized rate to you know, marginalized people. They are able to work more efficiently. Their kids do better at school because they don't have to struggle to get online all the time. They don't have to struggle with cable getting too busy at night because too many people are overloading their particular section.
And y'all wrecking my ping times in Rainbow Six when y'all getting on online after you get off school.
Yeah, but that anyway. Too. You're really making it hard for Jerry to win. And you still play Rainbow Six, really?
That's the best game ever.
Oh my god.
You just have to play with a headset to make
man,
it.
Man, I still haven't gotten around to playing Halo with Daniel.
I know, man. This is terrible. This needs to change. All right, anyway, so
I Eric, to your point, this is more like sanitary water, your sewer. There's if you were to make a brand new town in the middle of nowhere, there's nowhere to process your sewage, and there's no infrastructure to get your sewage from your house to that processing center.
No, I grew up outside of town. I had a septic tank, and that's what most of the homes in my neighborhood did.
And most of the homes in rural America have telephone lines delivering their internet, just like, you know, you had a septic tank. They don't have a big sewage treatment facility and a giant sewage pipe where you can flush hotel towels down the toilet if you wanted to, you know, try getting away with it. They have the bare minimum.
So this conversation is really important, and we'll hear a lot about what the FCC under Democrat power want to do with it. Obviously, one of the major parts of the conversation is around Section 230. This has been one of the issues that was brought to Ajit Pai's attention under an executive order by former President Trump. And it's still out there. It still needs to be resolved.
I'm sorry.
It's funny because it's not going to, I don't think it's going to change. But clearly, one of the things that Joe Biden had said was that he also wants to repeal Section 230, but for different reasons. It wasn't because of the suppression of conservative voices or that the big tech wasn't being held accountable for their actions, but more about the abuse that Section 230 allows online, and that it gives too much leeway to those companies to leave abuse up to make sure that it Section 230 makes it possible to facilitate some really gnarly stuff if there is no moderation being taken place.
Let's take a look at how poor moderation has allowed YouTube to become a cesspit of false information over the last 10 years, really.
Right.
But really has ramped up over the last 5.
You know what? I hope they repeal Section 230. If you're listening to this, you're not going to be able to comment on any of my stories on Android Central. I'm going to delete them. I don't want to be responsible for what you say. Then I'm going to call your ISP and tell them that you said something mean, and they're going to disconnect you. That's what repealing Section 230 gets you. If Verizon and Android Central and the Android Central are responsible for what you say, we're not going to let you say anything.
Right. That is that's the high level argument here. What's interesting though is that this conversation is not going to go away. Most people don't understand what Section 230 is, what it protects. It has nothing to do with free speech.
Like, nope.
It just is not, like, it has nothing to do with the First Amendment. It does not protect or not, it does not protect free speech online. It just doesn't. It focused on private companies where free speech or the First Amendment do not apply. It's not a public forum. Facebook isn't a public forum. Neither is Google. Neither is Twitter. So all that being said, we've talked about this so many times. What I'm curious about, though, is how does this new FCC sort of, do they just try to wipe the floor of everything that the previous FCC did? Or do they selectively roll back some policies while kind of like building on others? What do they do with Section 230, right? This is
well,
a conversation.
Section 230 wouldn't be handled by the FCC. Section 230 is something that Congress has to deal with.
Yes, but under this previous executive order, there's still a docket open at the FCC that has to be closed. So it's not a matter of whether the FCC is going to undertake, reforming Section 230, but do they have any enforcement under that filing? I don't know enough about it, but I do know that there is an open file around Section 230 that started back in July of 2020, and it is still open, and the new chairwoman has to figure out what to do with it. So, yeah, it's kind of that part of it is pretty interesting. I guess we'll wait and see. But all right, let's talk. Let's move on. Let's talk about this iMessage clone thing that is being touted by the former CEO of Pebble, Eric Mijakovsky. So it's called Beeper, and it is, I don't really know how it works, to be honest, but it's this consolidator for all of your chat. So you can put together Telegram, Signal, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter DMs, Slack messages, WhatsApp messages, and iMessages. And the way that it's supposed to work is that because you can use it natively on macOS and iOS, obviously, because there are API hooks for iMessage. But for Windows, Linux, and Android, it uses this sort of go-between that will then intercept if you have your own Mac or iPhone, I believe. No, if you have a Mac, you can use it basically as a server, similar to AirMessage. But if you don't, they will sell you a jailbroken iPhone 4S that will then be used as a go-between and facilitate your iMessage transfer to your Android phone, which
this
I think
is funny.
Hilarious.
Eric, I love you, and I'm sorry, but guys, don't do this. Just don't do this.
It's also $10 a month.
Well, I mean, the bigger thing here is in order for this to aggregate all of your messages, it has to unencrypt and see everything
ding, ding, ding,
everywhere. Like, I love the idea of this, but no. Like, I can't put my work Slack in there. Are you kidding me? No.
Do you want a jailbroken iPhone to be able to read, save, copy, and forward every single message you've ever typed? Ask yourself that. If the answer is no, then the answer is don't use this.
Well, so I mean, you don't have to do the iPhone 4S thing for everything. But yeah, but Beeper is doing the encrypting, not whatever service you were using ahead of time. So if you use this and you use Signal, then I don't know what the heck you're doing, because you're not. It's not safe.
So from what I understand about Matrix, which is this federated messaging protocol that Mijakovsky built last year.
It was invented by Keanu Reeves in 1989.
It is encrypted. It's end-to-end encrypted, but I guess it must decrypt, or I don't know how it does it.
It has to decrypt everything in order to gather it up and then re-encrypt it and send it to you, which means that this app has to be able to unencrypt everything that you send and receive.
The encryption that it puts back in place, heck, that could be better than the encryption it started with. But it has to decrypt it, at least in part, to know where to forward it to.
Yeah. So that means that it's no.
I'm just going to throw it out there that for that $10 a month, if you just up it to 16 a month, you can just finance an iPhone SE from Apple. If you need iMessage that bad, just get that and just carry it in a second pocket or something.
I just feel like maybe we should all just move backwards to iDan and just chirp each other.
I mean, if you're going that far, just go to IRC.
I was going to say, hit me on IRC.
The conversation began and still is for many people.
I mean, yeah, we have too many messaging apps, and it's a really alluring proposition to be able to just open one app for that instead of opening six apps. I converse with one of my best friends from Texas. I converse with him in both SMS and Instagram Messenger. He's the only person that I open Instagram for on a regular basis. But I would love to be able to talk to everybody in just one place. The problem with 21st century communication is that is not possible, and this app will not make it so.
I love that somebody is looking into how do we make a truly unified messaging service that includes a company who is just insistent on not participating. That means Apple, if you didn't catch what my, you know...
Also, anybody find it hilarious that Hangouts is in here, considering Hangouts dies this year?
Hangouts is never going to die.
I still use it every day.
Project Fi has to die first.
Yeah. So, I mean, right now you can't even sign up for this. You have to apply to pay $10 a month for early adopters.
No, that's the right way to do it. Because people that are curious about how we can break it are the people who are going to sign up for $10 a month. And we want those people to break it over and over and over again before
it
becomes
better.
Yes. So
one other thing that's interesting. So we heard that Google is slowly, silently rolling out end-to-end encryption in its Messages app for RCS. And as a result of that, if a phone is not capable of transmitting an end-to-end encrypted version of that message, it will start telling people at very soon that on March 31st, Messages will stop working on uncertified devices, including this one. We're not sure exactly what that means yet, if it's just a matter of if they're not safety net approved, right? It's not clear how Google will determine what is certified and what isn't. It could be that one is using an older version of Android or whatever.
I think that's the case.
It must be.
At the same time, I mean, Messages is just SMS. If Google Messages stops working, you roll your eyes, you go to Google Play, and you download Textra or Pulse, right?
You do, but a lot of people don't.
You right. A lot of people, they call Verizon or T-Mobile and say, what does this mean?
Yeah. It looks like it's based on GMS, right? So if you're trying to hack your Huawei phone, for instance, to work with GMS, and Google finds out, that's an uncertified phone. And I'm guessing that they will just stop letting encrypted messages go through or any RCS messages go through.
Or they put you under house arrest until Canada will extradite you. Yeah.
Yeah. They should do that with you anyway, Jerry. So.
Hey, I mean, I'm calling HR.
I'm sure Russell would love to hear from you.
One thing that I do want to point out, though, that so RCS is this like silent but deadly thing that I just love discovering when people have it on their phone. My mom started sending me chat messages the other day through RCS. And I guess she's been using a BlackBerry Key 2 for the last couple of years. And she doesn't update her apps. She doesn't do anything to anything, right? She clearly did not go into messages and just turn on chat. But all of a sudden, I guess Google forced an update to messages. Messages then pinged the server, saw that her carrier was compatible with RCS, turned on chat, and that was it. It was a silent change that she has no idea, like she does not understand the difference. But now we have read receipts. I can send her higher quality photos that aren't MMS. And it just worked. The way that iMessage just works when you turn on an iPhone and you connect to another iPhone user. And I love that. I think that it was so cool to see this just working. And it made me happy to think that Google was doing this all behind the scenes. And hopefully more Android users will discover that. The weird part, Hayato, and I want you to talk about this, because Samsung said that they made a big deal about pre-installing messages on the new Galaxy S21 phones, but that's not the case in the US. And I want to know, what is the messaging situation like on the S21 right now? Do you have messages pre-installed? It's just not the default, or do you have to download messages separately still?
You know, I wish I would have paid more attention to that when I first got the phones, but I always just do a restore from my previous backup, which installs messages onto every phone by default.
But was it the default messenger?
Like, no. So the Samsung messaging app is still the default.
Right.
I was setting up the smaller S21 earlier this morning, and you still have to, when you open the Google Messages app, you still have to set it as the default. I don't know if it comes pre-installed, but you do have to set it.
Well, do you have that new theme?
New theme?
Because Google Messages gets a One UI look on the S21, doesn't it? Or does it look like every other phone?
It on both of these phones, it's looked the same as everything else, as far as I've been able to tell.
Oh.
Well, I think all this shows is that more people need to be using the BlackBerry Key 2, where everything just automatically works instead of
on
buying.
Android. What is it? It's still on Oreo? Is that
yeah,
the...
I know.
I
know.
Think so.
It's going to be uncertified.
Any people? Sad.
Yeah, it's fleeting, because my mom's phone is going to be uncertified by Google in like 10 minutes.
Oh, remember Fleets?
Shut. No, stop.
Dude.
Stop.
But also, the other thing about RCS is it still matters a whole lot which carrier you have.
In the U.S., it does.
It does. Because I've used Google Messages, and I've had RCS turned on since the moment it was available in beta. But I have AT&T, and that doesn't mesh with RCS for some godforsaken reason.
Because
unless
you don't
you're
have
messaging
BlackBerry Key too.
But I thought Google fixed that in the U.S. I thought it just did its own thing if you're using Google Messages.
I don't know, but nobody I text gets. I don't have read receipts. I don't have any of that for anybody that I text.
I'm going to have to test this with you later, because I think...
I mean, I tested it with, I want to say, Jeremy back when it first started, and it wouldn't work.
AT&T, man. You're winning Ookla speed test, but you're still not conforming to
RCS
standards.
Is it time for just two carriers? T-Mobile should just buy AT&T.
Yeah,
no.
I think that would
fix it.
That's the clear solution to this.
Yes.
Less competition.
I'm just so happy that AT&T finally decided, okay, we're going to allow Wi-Fi calling on the unlocked Galaxy S21. Because that's the first unlocked Samsung phone that's going to allow Wi-Fi calling on AT&T.
My God, it's just like the little things that they do to make your life hard.
It's just the little things now, guys.
All right. I think that's all we have. We can keep talking, but I don't think we want to get into anything else. This has been a journey, is what I'm saying. This
but
podcast.
We haven't talked about the brown Galaxy S21 Ultra.
Oh my God.
I was listening to that podcast last night
and
I wanted to
again.
Reach through the screen, Jerry. That black is
that
ugly.
That brown is beautiful.
No.
It
the blue
know,
isn't
the color
a good color
car.
Either, but why did all of the S21 custom colors have to look that subdued and boring?
It's not that they're boring, it's what the hell is with the carbon fiber look on all of them?
Yeah, right? Does it wrap all the way around with the rest of the frame too? Do they carbon fiber the entire frame or just the camera module? But either way, God, why?
because carbon fiber is cool.
It sure was in 2015.
Yeah.
Shut up.
Because I keep having to include a carbon fiber case in every single Roundup. No.
Do you remember the Motorola Razr, like the 2011 version?
Do I remember
that was
it?
Wrapped in Kevlar?
Oh, yeah.
It was
I thought
best.
That thing was so sick when it came out.
Carbon
and then people
fiber
used
and
it, and then they proved me wrong.
Yeah.
It was a bad phone. Yeah. It was awful. Remember, that was back in the day when
Moto
we were
Blur.
Obsessed with on AMOLED Pixel, what was it called?
Screen door Pixel quad something.
Pentile?
Pentile,
yeah. Thank you. That's like a cursed word. My brain has just rejected it completely. Yeah, Pentile. That had one of the worst Pentile screens I think I'd ever seen.
Now
it was
I
a 720p display,
tomorrow.
And it was Pentile, and you could see every fucking pixel. It was awful.
Did you? All right, my swear jar. I'm going to be filthy rich.
I mean,
if we were going to break those out, could we have broken that out for Ajit Pai? Because really, screw him now and forever for all the things he said about
broadband
with 3 megabit up or 3 megabit down was reasonable.
This podcast is done. We're going to end on that. Goodbye. We'll catch you all next week. Us at JourneyDan at GBO. And remember, Daniel said
the F word.
We have
to do what's making us happy.
All right, we'll do what's making us happy, but I actually think Jerry should end the show because he does it better than I do. All right, Ara, what's making you happy this week?
Well, we got a new president, which was awesome, but I actually missed most of the inauguration because I went strawberry picking for the first time this year, and that felt great. And then I went to the parks for the first time that night. Yeah, that night. I've been to Epcot twice, and I finally started walking again, and my legs and my back are sore because of that, but I don't mind because it's actually me being able to get out of the house and get fit again.
January in Florida. Incredible.
It's going to be 85 on Monday.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, because in February it'll be 162.
Yeah, that's...
So
I'm not looking forward to the 85 degrees if for no other reason than I wanted to go take more photos of laptops, and that means that my back is just going to be sweaty from having my backpack against it all afternoon.
Oh, and poor Era has to sweat. Come on. Get out there. Enjoy it.
You disgust me.
It was 20 degrees outside when I filmed the S21 Ultra review.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I noticed those gloves.
It was 64 here yesterday.
Man.
All right, stop. Enough. This is making me depressed. Jerry, what's making you happy?
I had a really bad week last week, and just my faith in humanity was restored by just the outpouring of kindness from people who don't even know me. I'm just, a dude on the internet. And, I wrote about it. I had a little bit of rough time. My family was quite disrupted. A family member committed suicide. And I felt like maybe if I wrote about it a few paragraphs, it would make me feel better. And it did. But that's not the part that made me happy. What made me happy is people that I don't even know, people that I've never talked to before, contacted me just to say, chin up, bro, we love you. That you have no idea what that can mean to someone. Do it more often.
It was a beautiful piece, Jerry. You wrote, it was affecting. It was heartfelt. It was honest. It really it made me cry. I knew it would, but it made me cry. And it was a piece of catharsis that a lot of people needed to read.
Yeah, I needed to write it. So I'm glad you let me. And I cried while I was writing it, but I think it made me feel better once I just put words to paper, if that makes any sense.
Well, good for you, man. You made the best of an awful situation.
Yeah.
So
I tried and But really, do it more, guys. If you see somebody that just needs a slap on the shoulder or a smile, do it. You have no idea how much it means, maybe, but do it anyway.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to reading more of your stuff like that. I love your writing, but the heartfelt stuff is really good too. And even though it's an Android site and people one person had the audacity to complain about it, I banned him so fast it made me feel really good about that. So, all right, Hayato, what's making you happy?
Well, mine is nowhere near as profound, but it's making me happy either way. The rumors have been coming in more and more that Apple is going to be changing up its MacBook Pros very soon, and they're going to have SD cards are coming back, and there's no more Touch Bar, and they're fixing everything that I hate about my 2016 MacBook Pro.
But are they bringing back those weird, like, only half-length SD card slots, or is it going to be micro?
Who wants a micro SD slot on their laptop in 2021?
Well, who wants a half-size one like y'all did on the old Macs?
Me, because I don't need a dongle for that, and that's fine.
Yes, very much that. I love having an SD card a slot on the MacBook Pro.
But that is literally the only thing I need an adapter for at this point. Like, everything else you can adapt with a cable and just switch to USB-C. You can't USB-C an SD card. So I need that back for sure. Very happy about that. And obviously having a good keyboard is, I guess, not new anymore to MacBooks, but with my keyboard that I literally can't use anymore, and I have to write from my desk at all times, I love the idea of having that too. So there's that, you know, they're basically hitting reset and going back to like 2015 MacBook Pros, which were still the apex Apple laptop, I think.
And I heard there's going to be a new color called Rare Earth Brown.
With carbon fiber accenting on the on the trackpad. Heinous. So that's heinous. Certainly making me happy.
Well, I also look forward to that and not being able to justify buying it. What's making me happy this week, I've been playing this game on my Android phone called Dadish 2. It's a radish. It's a dad. It's a dadish. It's basically this like an old school platformer, really tough. You have to be precise. It uses very good on-screen controls, though there is controller support. It's a one-man operation. I think his name is Thomas Young. He just makes some really good mobile games, and he's one of those few indie, those rare indie developers that just like makes a high-quality indie game or mobile game for the sake of it. He's not trying to, you know, bring you back day after day, year after year. It's got 50 levels. Once you're done, you can play the game from the beginning, or you know, you can find something else. And I just appreciate the skill that goes into it. It's a lot like Celeste, but it's for mobile devices. And I've just been having a ton of fun in between, you know, reading on my phone or whatever. I also want to shout out a book that I'm reading called The Monk of Mocha. I forget the guy's name. Hang on. I always do this when I try to remember something. Dave Eggers. So Dave Eggers, he wrote one of my favorite books called What is the What? And he's got a bunch of other books out. And this is about the history of coffee. It's about a guy who tries to bring back Yemeni coffee into the world where Yemen was the birthplace of coffee, basically. And for many, many reasons, it has just fallen off. Production quality is down or was down. And it's about the story of a guy who goes and tries to work with the farmers to improve the quality and to bring it back into the world in terms of distribution. So it's a really good book. I really enjoyed it. And I highly recommend it if you're into coffee or just like coffee culture in general. Yeah. So that's making me happy this week. All right. Well, Jerry, I think you got us started. So end the show for us.
Era has to tell us what's making her happy.
I went first.
She went first. She told us.
Oh, see,
I weren't listening, you jerk.
I wasn't paying attention.
Strawberries
I was
and theme parks, bro.
I was playing Dad Radish on my phone. But
yeah, it's okay.
Thank you for listening to the Android Central podcast. We do this every week, almost every week. Sometimes we miss a week, but not very often. We're awesome because you make us awesome. You can mail us hate mail, love mail, requests for Jerry to earn a raise, whatever you want, to podcast@Android Central. And you can find each of us mostly on Twitter. That's where I'm going to plug it. It's You can find Era at Era Wagco.
Yep.
You can find Daniel at Journey Dan. You can find Hayato at Fingers. No, I mean Hayato Huseman. Inside joke. And you can find me at GB Hill. And feel free to bug us, because if we're talking to you on Twitter, that means we're not here banging on keys and slaving away for Daniel. So do that as many times as you want. We're there for you because you are here for us. We love you all.
Adios.
Bye. Oh my, that was, yes, adios.